August 19th, 2011, it's the Lullabot Podcast.
Lullabot Podcast.
Hi everyone, it's Jeff Robbins, back with episode 95 of the Lullabot Drupal Podcast. Today on the podcast, we've got an interview with the father... what are we calling him, Jared?
The king of web standards.
The king, and also the father. I think that can be...
Business Week dubbed him king of web standards.
So, Jared Ponchot and I are doing an interview with Jeffrey Zeldman, who is... web celebrity, omnipresent on the web. As we'll hear, he has started lots of web projects and companies, and basically is one of the people sort of responsible for browsers working the way they do these days. And we're going to have an interview with him. We wanted to mention a couple of things we've got coming up at Lullabot. First of all, we're going to be at DrupalCon next week in London. If you're listening to this podcast shortly after it comes out and you're going to be at DrupalCon in London, please come by our booth. We are a sponsor and we'll be giving away stickers and handshakes, hugs, you know, whatever. Come on by and talk to us. We love to talk to people who listen to the podcast and we'll be there in London. Also, we've got the Do It With Drupal conference coming up in New York City, October 12th, 13th, and 14th at the Brooklyn Bridge Marriott in Brooklyn. Funny enough, Jeffrey Zeldman will be keynoting, as well as Josh Clark, who we did an interview with a few weeks ago. We've got lots of really great people speaking, and it's really a great way to immerse yourself into Drupal, catch up with the latest Drupal stuff, and we're going to be talking about a lot of future technologies and sort of keeping everyone up to date when it comes to Drupal and adjunct technologies. You can find out more about that conference at doitwithdrupal.com. There's an early bird discount, which is happening right now through September 1st. So go to doitwithdrupal.com and register today if you want to save some money. Also, wanted to mention, we've still got DrupalizeMe, DrupalizeMe. New videos going up there all the time. We've just put up an intro to views video, or series of videos for views for Drupal 7. New videos there. Videos about Drush, installing Drush, getting Drush to work. Drush is one of those things that once you get it working, it feels like magic. But until you get it working, it feels like you don't know how you're going to get it working. And so we've got videos about how to get it working up on DrupalizeMe. So go to Drupalize, DrupalizeMe for more information about all the videos that you can find there. All right. Jeffrey Zeldman, welcome to the Lullabot Podcast.
Hey, thank you for having me, Jeff. And hi, Jared.
Hi. Great to have you.
Thank you. It's great to be had.
So I'm trying to figure out when we met. I feel like we've just sort of known each other for ad infinitum.
Yeah, well,
sort of South by Southwest-ish stuff.
Maybe, so that would be like 2000-ish.
Yeah.
But you've been doing this since the 90s, as have I.
On and off, yeah. I worked at O'Reilly early on, and as did my wife, but then I left to go play music.
Rock and roll.
Play music for a living. But now I'm back.
Yeah, so. Well, I used to be a musician too. I mean, I guess I still am, but not.
Same here.
Yeah, you can never lose it. It's like once you're an alcoholic, You can't. Can't go back.
Right.
Once you're a pickle, you can't go back to being a cucumber. Once you're a musician.
I like that one.
Although I think most musicians would resent being compared to alcoholics.
Or pickles.
Or, yeah. Yeah.
I have felt a bit pickled.
Yeah, there we go.
From time to time. So let's see. So let's sort of do a quick background for the uninitiated of Jeffrey Zeldman. You are web famous, but much like Zsa Zsa Gabor, sometimes we wonder why.
Ooh. Very nice.
Because she wasn't actually on Green Acres. It was her sister, right?
It was her sister, Ava Gabor.
Right, yeah. All she's really famous for is, like, hitting a cop or something. I don't know. But my references are very
old. I did that, too. That's how I got famous.
There you go.
There was a guy. I knew a guy on the internet. This is not me. I knew a guy on the internet who was famous in the blogging era, like, early 2000s. He was famous for... he got famous because he was the guy fired for having a blog. So it was before Deuce was fired for having a blog. This guy, and I won't name him, he actually didn't get fired for having a blog. He got fired for writing sex fantasies about his female coworkers and then asking them to read his blog. He said, hey, Marsha, like at the water cooler. Hey, Marsha, you know I have a website. You ought to check it out.
Oh, man.
Yeah. So,
where's that supposed to go, really?
I don't know where it went. Was he lost his job. But instead of getting into therapy, he became web famous. So anything I say after that is going to make me seem noble, right? So I started designing websites in 1995. My first client was Warner Brothers. Don Buckley came to the ad agency where I was working and said, we know this Batman movie is going to be big and we want it to be on the web. We know the web is going to be big, but nothing's big now. And can you guys make a website? And we lied and said yes, like everybody. And we collaborated with an agency that existed at the time called Interactivate, not the Interactivate that exists now, but it was because they knew how to do Perl and we didn't. And we did an animation for the website by modulating between, you know, they wrote a Perl script, which because it was before GIF animation. So GIF animation. So we had like five images of the bat that were progressively larger, and they used the Perl script to modulate between them, and it was a big hit. There were 3 million. Wow. There were 3 million web users, and we had 1.5 million visitors, which was half the goodness. Internet. And I said, "This is what I want to do for the rest
of my life."
It's not bad. Yeah, it's never going to be that good again. Seriously.
Come on, it's got to be better now. We have GIF animations.
But I have half the internet. I'm never going to have that again. So, So I started blogging in 1995. I started.
We didn't call it blogging back then.
We didn't. I started teaching other people how to do web design, and I had a site called Ask Dr. Web because I figured everyone was going to learn HTML. Well, anyway, in 1998, if you remember, when Netscape 3 and Internet Explorer 3 and Netscape 4, Internet Explorer 4, there were four incompatible ways to design a website, and most people were down with that. Everything was table layouts, and everything was, I know JavaScript, and I know JScript, and I know, you know, and people were getting money for knowing the four or five different incompatible ways to make a website. And we started the Web Standards Project, and our goal was to get everyone to design websites using standards, our goal was to get browsers to actually support standards. And by standards, I mean the front end standard, you know, HTML, HTML4 at the time, 4.01, CSS, and JavaScript.
Because there weren't even ways, or at least ways hadn't been devised yet, to create the same web page for multiple browsers, hacks or any of that kind of stuff.
None of that existed.
You had a lot of stuff where the web server was testing and serving different pages to different browsers, and
the back-end people were very smart and got involved right away, and basically web designers would do like four different table layouts, because even the table layouts, you couldn't. And even the limited CSS that was supported I have to say, at the beginning, Internet Explorer was the more standards compliant browser, which and it's good again, but it's taken like 10 years for it to get good again. So, but anyway, we said there was Opera, there was Internet Explorer, and there was Netscape, if you remember Netscape, which at the time dominated, but is now like a historical. it's Ozymandias. It's like Babylon. It's like gone. So you know, so we, and by we, I mean, let's say Tim Bray, Dory Smith, a lot of people, got together, George Olson, Glenn Davis, George Olson, Steve Champion, a lot of people got together and, you know, and formed the Web Standards Project. And we basically said, you know, the W3C calls CSS a recommendation, but it's really a standard, and browsers should support it accurately and completely before you add colored scroll bars or other new scripting languages or other stuff. Support this. And HTML is a standard specification, even if the W3C calls it a recommendation. And you should support HTML before you support some new language that might or may not, some proprietary innovation. We said innovation's great. Get the standards right, and then and anyway, we were nobody. We were just like 10 people.
But you started to provide a vision where there hadn't really been a unified vision, and ultimately sort of a vision from the designers and users rather than the developers who were creating the browsers, who didn't seem to have much of a perspective.
Developers were right. So the developers were worked at the behest of the marketers, and the marketers, they looked at it like Photoshop versus Fireworks. If, you know, back in the day when those were separate from separate companies, Fireworks would have one set of features, and Photoshop would say, "Oh yeah, well we've got these features, right?" Or Word versus WordPerfect. If you go way back, ask your grandfather. Back when there was more than one mainstream office product, and they competed on features. When the web was, Mark. Wow, I'm blanking on his last name, but you know his last name.
Andreessen?
Yes, Mark Andreessen, when he invented Netscape, I mean, it was a software product. And when Internet Explorer came along competing with it, they saw it as competitive. You went to the store and bought a browser, right, on a disk, and installed it.
Right. Yeah. Right?
So it's software. So they were competing on features. And we said, if you guys keep doing that, the web will fragment. And it will become impossible for all but the most, the biggest companies to have websites. And this is silly. And when developers would come to us and say, well, yeah, but you know how much we get paid for knowing the five ways to make a website? We would say, sure, but what if you could get the same budget, but instead you could spend it on photography, graphic design, get your copy in advance, pay a writer. You know, pay a copy editor to make sure there weren't spelling errors. Like, do more. You know, you could spend more on research. You could spend more on user experience. You could, if your client has a lot of money, you can always find a way to spend it. But maybe you shouldn't be spending it all just trying to make an ugly page work for five different browsers.
Yeah.
So, amazingly, and not without struggle, the browser companies got in line. And by 2000, they were starting to fall in line. And by 2001... all the major browsers supported web standards. Certainly not to the degree that they do now, but sufficiently that with some hacks and tricks, we could do CSS layout instead of table layout. And the reason that was important was, with table layouts, there's no real semantics. So you can't really repurpose the content, and it's not very portable. Someone with a screen reader doesn't really know what's the most important headline on the page. They can't navigate via headlines or secondary headlines. They're sort of stuck just reading text randomly. Be kind of like sending, as if everything was in ASCII. And the accessibility piece was really important to us, but that never, what really sold it was Google. Because all this time while we're doing this, Google's rising from nowhere to become this amazing search engine that just works. And Google knows that an H1 headline is more important than an H2. And so now, you go to your client and say, for accessibility and to make sure that they don't, I mean, an enlightened client might care, but another client might not care. They might say, look,
that I always use is, the client's going to say, what percentage of people coming to our website are going to be blind? Let's be honest. I mean, 5%, 10%, and it's going to cost us twice as much to make the site accessible for them. But when you start talking about Google, it's a whole different game.
Right. Exactly. You tell them for accessibility folks, Google is the biggest blind user on earth. because Google navigates your page and understands your content exactly the same way a blind person using a screen reader does, right? And so if you make your page friendly to the greatest search engine on earth, the Uber, you know, the our new overlords, it will also be friendly to a screen reader. So that's how we won that argument. That's how we started selling standards and semantic markup to our clients. So first, the browsers had to support it. So once that happened, I left the Web Standards Project. I turned over leadership of it to Molly Holschlag, and then eventually she turned it over to a couple of people, and it's gone. You know, it's gone. It's quieted down, and it's now mostly focused on education. There's a lot of good, really good people still doing stuff through it, but it's very low profile now. I felt that it served its purpose. The browser makers were now compliant, but the problem was it didn't stop developers, front end developers from and back end developers who dabble in front end, from still writing the same crap markup and crap scripting. So, for instance, you had a browser that supported XHTML, HTML4, CSS, and JavaScript, and then you had people writing non-semantic gobbledygook with break tags and meaningless divs and no semantics. And so it really became about educating the client why, you know, to the SEO and accessibility benefits of web standards, and educating our fellow designers and developers about these benefits. And I approach that, first of all, I have a web magazine, listapart.com, mm-hmm. Listapart, which has been around since 98. And we really, really focused on getting folks interested in, you know, all the things you could do with CSS. Like, you know, a lot of people have since learned it, like through the CSS Zen Garden, that it's possible to, which is a wonderful site by Dave Shea and millions and thousands of contributors. You know, CSS separation of design from content is really good, and here's why. But, you know, we had an article about CSS style switching, like real early, just to show people, you know, and you could do that for accessibility purposes, give someone who needs help bigger type. So we did a lot of stuff, and we have a lot of wonderful authors, and we had amazing editors like Aaron Kassane and then Krista Stevens and Mandy Brown working to, you know, working with those authors and making sure that, you know, so anyway, all that was going on. But also, I wrote this book, Designing with Web Standards.
The Beanie Book.
Yeah, so in 2003, I wrote this book. And when new writers asked me to write it, I said, oh, everybody knows about web standards. And they said, no, they really don't. I said, no, they really do. Everyone knows this. And they said, no, actually, believe it or not, not everybody knows who you are, what you've done, and web standards. And, of course, they were right. Most people didn't. So that book's been translated into, like, 13 languages. There's now a third edition, which I wrote last 2 years ago with Ethan Marcotte, brilliant guy. But that book basically made the front of that book is like a Bible for web designers and developers and people who own websites, clients. And it's basically, it's the reason semantic markup matters. It's the reason proper CSS and browser support matter. It's the stuff we've been talking about in more detail, mm-hmm. right? And it made the case. And so it converted people. And I was at South by Southwest 1 year, and I met Zeldman of Japan. That's how his wife introduced him to me. She said, "He is Zeldman of Japan," and he was a guy who was
Japanese doppelganger.
Well, he was converting people to web standards. That's what she meant. She meant he was the guy going around to companies explaining why SEO was good, accessibility was good, light, you know, lower bandwidth was good. You know, and Japan, of course, they were way ahead of us with mobile, so they knew why lower bandwidth was good. In America, we were going, everybody's got cable modems now, right? So I can make this page as fat as I want, right? And, you know, so it's funny because we're now, you know, now with mobile, we're sort of going through a whole second web standards.
Right. Uh-huh. It's a new justification, a new reuse and repurpose of the same.
The same, yeah. And content. And there's obviously, there's, you know, you can approach that, you can take a back-end point of view, right? Make a separate template for mobile, and maybe that is the best way in a lot of cases. Or you can do what Ethan Marcotte recommends in his responsive web design book, you know, and explore CSS techniques and design principles with fluid grids, flexible images, and media queries to reconfigure your page so that it works for any size device. And so there's an optimum experience for a small screen device, a different optimum experience for a desktop browser, a different optimum experience for a tablet. But we're not talking about sniffing and going, oh, you're an Android tablet. Well, then in that case, it's not about that. It's right. not about that. It's about flexibility. And it's really about, I don't know if you remember John Alsop's article, The Tao of Web Design, from like 12 years ago mm-hmm. on A List Apart. But it's really about that. That was about the web is fluid and it changes, it comes and goes, and we should design that way. And of course, no designer wanted to hear that in 1998 or whenever he wrote it, because we all wanted to make, you know, perfect grids that looked like, we wanted to make stuff that looked like books or...
It's such a pendulum, isn't it, right? I mean, early on, it was impossible to do pixel-perfect designs. Right. You just sort of knew that the browsers were going to F it up in one way or another, and you didn't know exactly how. So you'd sort of make a shot at it and sort of hope for the best. And then we got to a point where you could make pixel-perfect designs. And now, you know, we've swung past that, and we're back to, well, you're designing for this, but we also want to make it fluid enough so that it works in these different ways for different browsers. And each of those is, you can control it, but we've got this, you know, especially with the responsive design, web design stuff, and maybe, well, I guess you've defined it, but, you know, the same web page using CSS, what are they called?
Media queries.
Media queries, exactly. You know, you can tell the CSS how wide the browser is, and depending on that, it'll bring in different selectors and lay things out slightly differently. But it's the same page.
It's the same page, but maybe it's using a different size illustration. Maybe it's skipping a secondary illustration for a phone user because, you know, bandwidth is limited, and why should they download that? There's a lot of logic in it.
And yeah, but we're back sort of to the, like, well, it looks this way now, but
I know. Well, and it's very challenging. So I see almost three phases of web design, right? So in the first phase, there were those with graphic design training who were struggling to make everything look the same in every browser, and others who were saying it doesn't have to look the same in every browser. And that was usually a losing argument with clients. Then there was the second phase where you have people like Jason Santa Maria, who I've worked with, or, you know, who actually have like a very strong graphic design background, but actually understand the web. So no longer is it like designer versus developer, right? In phase one, the person who actually, you know, wrote the HTML would say, you can't do that. Or, well, I interpreted it and it's going to, we're going to use M's. And the designer's like, you use pixels, don't use M's. It's a relationship, you know, and they're fighting, right? In the second phase, and of course, there were always people who had skills at both, always. Like everyone on this podcast had skills at both. But then there's the second phase where there are people who are really, really, really good graphic designers who got the web and could code, right? And that was a whole thing. And we've just gotten to a point where everyone was like, yeah, 1024 by 768. And we've got this, you know, we've got this 18 column grid. And my God, Joseph Mueller Brockman is rising from the grave and saluting us with tears in his eyes. This is the great, you know, and they're all really excited about really finished optimum quality graphic design in HTML and CSS. Mm-hmm. And so what happens? We throw, right? Ethan Marcotte comes on and says, you know, guys, with mobile and with all these tablets, and that doesn't make sense anymore. I don't know what size I'm designing for. I really never did. But now let's stop pretending that everyone has, I don't know, everyone has a 27-inch iMac. That's not reality.
Yeah.
And now we're going right back. So all the designers who have 27-inch iMacs and who are really excited about all the things, we're going, oh, yeah. That's right. We're the only ones in our office who have these.
Yeah. It's funny, you know, these surveys and statistics and agreements, right, that, okay, we're going to do web pages that are 1,000 pixels wide, 1024, you know, for a 1024, everybody's got at least a 1024 screen. So let's go with a 960 grid. Right. That gives us enough little space on the side. 960, everybody go!
Yeah.
And immediately, you know, I mean, I feel like people just sort of settled on a 960 grid last year before, something like that. And
actually, 2005. But yeah, it feels that way. It feels like you finally nailed that.
It sort of settled in, you know. It was like, we can do this. This is what we're doing. And now, already, it's sort of like, well, that'll work for one browser.
And so our last redesign for List Apart was a 1024 by 768 designed by Jason Santa Maria and coded by Dan Cederholm. And it was a 1024 by 768 in 2005. And in 2005, people were like, are you crazy with this widescreen thing? This is a monstrosity. And then New York Times, like, everybody did it.
Right.
Everybody did it. So we're like, yeah, 1024. And now, of course, we're working on a mobile responsive redesign where we're basically throwing out all that stuff. And, you know, because and everybody, it seems like everybody cool is working on responsive web design, which is kind of silly. I'm sure there's cool people listening to this who aren't working on it, but they're thinking about it. They're thinking about it because it makes sense. I mean, there's also, I guess we should clarify between responsive and adaptive web design. Talk about that a little bit. And I hate all this buzzwordy sounding stuff, but what Ethan Marcotte meant by I like to think that responsive just means aware that we're not designing for a single size screen or a single use case, mm-hmm. and responding. But Ethan Marcotte, who actually coined the phrase, means something different. He means very specifically fluid grids, flexible images, media queries, all that stuff's part of it. And basically, if your columns stay the same and your images stay the same size and everything, that's not responsive in his. That's adaptive, which may be fine. So adaptive design is where you also, you know, where you also are aware that there's multiple sizes and multiple user experiences, but maybe you do have, you know, so you alternate between, say, three or four fixed widths. And, you know, you use maybe the same size images. They just, you know, maybe there's three images next to each other at widescreen, and that becomes two images next to each other in a smaller screen, and one image in, you know, on a phone.
Right.
So it's a little. It's, you know, there's pros and cons for both, and people do spend hours arguing about that, and we're not going to. But I just think, you know, adaptive, responsive. It's just very hard to justify a new design that's a fixed width design. It doesn't think about this stuff at all.
Yeah.
I think this is where the industry is going.
I think, you know, obviously this is still, I think it probably still qualifies as cutting edge. It's not something that everyone's doing yet. Part of the reason that not everyone's doing it yet is there haven't been enough examples out there. There aren't a whole lot of, you know, sites to call up and say, here, see, this is how they do it. I use this site every day. Facebook's not doing it, for example. You know?
Right.
And I think, you know, when we start seeing more examples, more role models for designers and developers, then I think we'll start seeing more of it. I mean, we just haven't gotten to that tipping point yet.
Exactly.
But it's on the horizon.
So the CSSN garden was Dave Shea, and he'd made a couple of things, and then maybe there was five people doing it, and then suddenly thousands of people were doing it, and it was a whole different thing. And web standards catching on, you know, a List Apart in 2001, we switched to a CSS-based layout, same crappy design, CSS layout. It was like, come on, do CSS layout. And then there was like a lull for about a year, and then Douglas Bowman, who worked at Wired, redesigned hotwire.com using web standards and CSS layout, and people were like, oh. And then Mike Davidson redesigned ESPN. That was really killer, right? ESPN using web standards, right? And people were like, oh, wait, you can do this with real sites, not just with your little magazine there. And I think that's, I mean, there's a lot of, the Boston Globe is being redesigned to be responsive.
Yeah.
Parts of the New York Times now are. It's hard too because we just finished building all these systems that like the New York Times, they have this nice widescreen look and feel. And then if you go with a mobile device, they use JavaScript to detect that, and then they send you a little mobile experience. So they just finished paying for that. Do they really want to rethink it all? You know, I mean, there's that too. There's Roger Black used to describe, actually, he used to describe Internet Explorer as this very handsome salesman with an old man strapped to his back and a dead man strapped to that guy's back. Because that's the problem with Internet Explorer. Even though Internet Explorer is going to be, 10 is going to be awesome, and 9 is fantastic, and 8 wasn't bad at all, and 7 was, you know, there's, you just keep going back until there's something you have to support that's
still,
old.
Right, space. Still backwards compatible with everyone's intranet system that was built in 1997.
Right. Microsoft spent years evangelizing the corporations going, I mean, that was the one of the biggest struggles with web standards adoption was going to companies and they go, well, you know, we standardize on IE6, and we're like, oh, we're sorry, but you know, they're like, well, we just paid $1 million for this intranet that uses table layouts, and yeah, so there's still that, and there's still, you still find stuff like that out there. It's amazing. Yes. And that sounded like a painful yes.
Yes, it is a painful yes.
Well, do you want to speak out of school?
I don't know if I'm actually allowed to talk about
something. No one's listening.
It can be fairly surprising.
Suffice to say, corporations have long memories.
Yes.
So, right. Corporations that in other ways are present themselves as very cutting edge might have cutting edge products.
It's fascinating too, because I think that technology is forcing designers beyond web designers and even beyond the web. Technology is forcing designers to think beyond a particular context and medium. If you look at what's happening even in book design, you can't just say, I'm not a web designer, I'm a book designer anymore, without actually thinking about that this headline might span two lines instead of one, depending on this person's ebook reader and what they set their font size setting to and all these kinds of things. So I think that there's a shift happening just in the design community in general, where designers are just being forced to think beyond a fixed print medium, you know, even if they're not a web designer.
Bravo. I totally agree, Jared. And I think this is the real convergence. You know, people were talking about, you're going to play chess with a friend in Vietnam on your TV. And that was supposed to be convergence. but I think this is the real convergence, that a book is becoming digital as well as print, and a website isn't just something you sit and look at on your desktop anymore. Yeah. Right? We run a conference now called In a Bed Apart, and Luke Rablewski is one of our more popular speakers, and he's always talking about mobile and the mobile experience. And he's one of those guys that argues from data. I like to argue from emotion. Right? Like, that's not right. You shouldn't do that. But he likes to argue from data. Like, well, he talks about they predicted that in 2014 mobile usage of the web would exceed desktop usage of the web, and it was considered an outlandish prediction, but it actually happened in 2010, and just like, you know, twice as many smartphones are selling as desktop computers now, or as PCs now. That includes laptops. Wow. Yeah. So for every laptop or desktop PC sold, someone's buying two smartphones.
And there are more phones on the earth than there are people now, or something like that. I heard.
Yeah, it's crazy. So this is the real convergence. All this stuff is happening. It's a really exciting time to be designing, but you do want to be aware of these basic issues about you know, semantics and CSS layout and source order, controlling source order for better SEO results and for better accessibility, which, again, they're kind of the same thing, guys. You want to be aware of those things, because I think if you're not, if you've got this amazing backend and you can do anything, but you look at HTML as just sort of baby programming language, it's not. It's not supposed to be, you know, people, sometimes back-end people look at HTML with scorn and like, well, that's just, you know, that's nothing. My mother could write that. But that's sort of the point, right? That's sort of the point. In his book, HTML5 for Web Designers, Jeremy Keith says in the first paragraph, HTML is this incredibly simple tag-based markup language that allows all human expression. Right? From the works of Shakespeare to cats that look like Hitler.
Indeed.
And that's really powerful. The fact that it's so simple that anyone can learn it and use it properly, that's not a cause for scorn. That's a cause for awe. To me, that means be the most kick-ass programmer you are, but respect the front end. Respect HTML. the fact that it's simple is good. That's it. That's a benefit to it. Does that make any sense?
Yeah.
Well, it sort of comes back to that Zen, you know, simple is good. And this is, you know, it's the delivery mechanism, the alphabet. We've got 26 letters, and yet you can write a novel. Right, you get a little punctuation in there from time to time. But, you know.
Nice. How can I subscribe to this podcast?
We're on the web. We're on iTunes, man.
You guys are awesome. Yeah. This is great.
So what are you excited about now? You're talking about responsive design. What are you up to?
Well, we have formed a publishing company. We didn't intend to, but it was weird. Everybody else was like making Web 2.0 fortunes, and we decided to go Gutenberg. And so we're now at a point where the EPUB versions are actually outselling the printed versions. But we make these lovely little printed books called, the name of the company is A Book Apart, kind of like A List Apart, an Event Apart. You know,
right.
Kind of.
Good branding.
Yeah.
They're fantastic books, by the way.
They are.
I think I own every single one that you've put out so far, and they're fun to read. They're simple. Easy to engage, and like they're nice and short and condensed, and yeah, love the approach.
I think a formative book for me was "Don't Make Me Think" by Steve Crew. Not that we're copying it, and not that our authors are copying it, but what among many things that I loved about that book, I understood usability much better after reading that book. I understand why it mattered to design, I got it. And it was a very short book. If you check out all the pictures, it's a very short book. It's a book designed to be read on an airplane between New York and Chicago. So you leave New York, or you leave Boston, and you go into D.C., whatever. You know, pick your favorite short flight. That's what that book's designed to do, and that's what our books are designed to do. Again, we're not copying, but that idea kind of stuck in our heads. The idea that a book could be 60 pages, 80 pages, 100 pages, they tend to be more like 100, but that in about 90 minutes you could learn, so you could read The Elements of Content Strategy by Aaron Kassane and get what content strategy is, why it matters to you, and how to implement it even if you're not primarily a content person. Right, or CSS3 for Web Designers by Dan Cederholm, and you could learn, you know, everything that you could implement now in CSS3 using progressive enhancement so that it would work for everyone. Right? So if it doesn't work, it doesn't matter. It's just a simple extra layer of pleasure for people whose browsers happen to support it. So we've got our latest book out is Responsive Web Design by Ethan Marcotte. It's fantastic. Designing for Emotion by Aaron Walter is coming this fall. And that will be followed by Mobile First by Luke Rabluski. And these are really, yeah, I'm glad you like them. People ask us if we'll start a subscription service. We'd love to, but the problem is we don't print on schedule. We publish when there's a book that needs to be written and read. We publish a book that, you know, if we were publishing 5 books a year every, you know, or 6 books a year every 2 months, we could start a subscription service. So we haven't figured out a way to do that when our schedule is as needed. But we really publish books we feel are needed as they are needed by authors who are funny and witty and have a really strong point of view.
This is an interesting move, right? At least it felt for me back in the 90s that there were a lot of people moving from print onto the web, and it was a whole new world and a whole new language. And here you are moving from the web, but adding on books, right. Design and stuff like that. How has getting into that provided a new perspective or what's that like, you know, moving into print?
We all love books. We're all book nerds. Mandy Brown, our editor, was at Norton for 10 years. Jason Santa Maria, our designer, you know, loves books, big book nerd. I would rather read than almost anything else. And I'd also been, I work with New Writers for a long time as a published author there. And, you know, when you work with O'Reilly, so, you know, when you work with a really good publishing company, you do get some idea what's going on. And you understand a little bit about how they love their authors and take care of their authors and all that. So that part wasn't new. I started Happy Cog, an agency, in 1999, and we really have deep relationships with the people who work with us for us. So it wasn't really mentoring talent or fostering talent or finding people who are super talented and just like loving them for it and letting them be themselves. That stuff wasn't new. So the whole relationship thing wasn't new. And we had a really simple business idea for the books, which is that the author gets half the profits. Hmm. So basically we have almost no overhead. We don't print on demand because that doesn't really leave the quality. So we take a little risk. We say, well, we're gonna print 10,000 of these and see what happens. But they very quickly become profitable, and they're priced cheaply. So, you know, they're not stupidly priced. Anyone can afford them. But basically, the author ends up earning more than they would in another, you know, in a more traditional publishing arrangement. The author gets half and the company keeps the other half, which is divided between the partners and whatnot and covers expenses. But the thing is, that doesn't mean that you wouldn't want to work with a traditional publisher. You often would. I think if you want to be in, you know, in every airport, you'd work with a traditional publisher. If you want to make your name and you don't have a name, it's better to work with O'Reilly or New Writers or Peach Pit, somebody like that, you know, to start building your reputation. I don't think you want to, if you have no reputation, I don't know that you could write a book like this and it would be successful, because part of this is, you know, it's not just a book apart and what people think about us. It's also that they know who Aaron Cassane is, you know, Jeremy Keith, Ethan Marcotte, Dan Cederholm, Aaron Walter. They know those people have spent, you know, put in years writing articles, you know, writing previous books, so that, you know what I'm saying? It's kind of like, I don't know, it's like a super group.
Yeah.
Right? And so we have a conference, an event apart, and many of the same people who speak at the conference end up writing books for us, and how we find that, you know, we hear them talking about this amazing subject, we realize it's really important. We see them over the course of a year or two refining the topic, and we know, well, this is what they have to speak about. This is amazing, right? Like responsive web design. So none of that was new. So what did we learn? Well, we learned all the horrible stuff that, you know, the reason that the publishing companies have scars, you know, and the reason the publishing company people are idealistic and sweet, but, you know, they have like patches over their eyes, and because, you know, a lot of stuff can happen. There's a lot of contractual stuff you need to know about that we didn't know when we started. There's the fun of selling translation rights. There's, it's working really well for us so far. I don't want to jinx it. And it's really, for us, it's not about making tons of money, but helping an author get a book in the hands of like 30 or 40,000 people who really need to hear that idea, and knowing that that author is doing well, that's great. That's great. And so we feel really good about it. And it ties in with the conference, right? There's many, you know, if you loved Ethan's book, you might want to come hear him speak for a whole day about responsive design at an event apart, and maybe you can do that. So, I don't know.
Yeah, yeah. So, there's a subject I wanted to sort of touch on. I'm not quite sure where to take this exactly, but so to sort of bring things back around to Drupal, our world of Drupal, there's a lot of a talk, Jared, I think you've been sort of working this up for the Do It With Drupal conference, right? About sort of designing for and thinking about design and markup for content management systems, you know, and ultimately just sort of design systems. Jeffrey, you talk a lot about sort of keeping things simple, and Drupal has a tendency to overcomplicate things.
Right.
You get developers who inherently don't know, I mean, especially in open source and in the Drupal sort of modular system where you're creating, and they are called modules in Drupal, you're creating these little plugins that are going to provide a bit of functionality, and all that the developer knows is I'll probably be in some kind of a div, and then I'm going to put my content in a div, and then people can put their content in that div, and you know, and that's how we end up. And the way that the back end, you know, tends to work is all of these things are sort of these Russian dolls of functionality. This inside yes. of that one, this inside of that one, and it ends up getting rendered that way on the page as well. It's a difficulty of Drupal, and I think one that I don't know if enough people in Drupal are even aware of the problem, because technically we're outputting semantically, well, I don't know if it's semantically correct, but it's
it'll validate
right? It's valid. It's potentially accessible, and again, I think with developers and also in open source, there tends to be this solution of adding more. We'll add more classes to make it semantic. We'll add more divs to make it, you know. I'm just sort of curious to hear from probably both of you, Jared and Jeffrey, sort of on this problem and sort of, I don't know what. How are we going to solve this?
You know, Nicole Sullivan gives a really good talk at Internet Apart about CSS optimization. One of the things that happens, exactly like you're talking about, say at a big company like Facebook, just to pick, you know, it could be any big company, but she'd worked at Facebook as a consultant for a while working on this very problem. So you've got, you know, there's one color blue, but there may be like 500 lines of CSS calling that line of, you know, calling, specifying that same mm-hmm. line of color blue with ever more specific, because, you know, you create a rule and it doesn't work. So you're like, oh, it's not specific enough. So then it's like, you have like div class equals such and such, div class equals so and so. You know, if the div is in this class and in this class and inside this, this ID and has this class name, then give me that color blue, right? And so you end up with like all this super fat congested code because just to get the color blue, because there's so many people working on the project at once. And that, I think that maps to what's happening at Drupal, because you have all these really brilliant people working separately, mm-hmm. each in a little module, each in a little like turret or something, or in a little silo going, well, here's how to fix that. It's kind of like, and it's not limited to Drupal. I mean, if you take something less robust than Drupal, you take like a nice blogging platform, you use someone's plugin to, you know, to put up, let's say I want people to know, let's say on my blog, on my WordPress blog, I want people to know that I have a Facebook page and a Flickr page. So instead of writing my own lean markup and putting those two Facebook and Flickr buttons on, I use some plugin, some WordPress plugin that someone else authored. Now I've suddenly got something like 1,000 divs in an iframe because it worked, and it probably bypassed. It probably started as a simple problem, and then someone said, you know, that's not working anymore on my site because of such and such problem. He said, oh, that's simple. I'll just wrap everything in another div, and I'll give that an extra class name, and then I'll write a couple lines of JavaScript, and that'll fix that for you, right? I mean, that's what happens. Mm-hmm. So all solving, it's like we start out with a simple general thing, but then someone says, yeah, but that makes my phone ring when that happens. Or, that makes my watch stop. And so you're, that's okay. I'll add 5 more lines of JavaScript. It's you know, and it's the same reason. It's the same reason a lot of times when we do a redesign of a website, we end up throwing away most of the code that's there. You know, we'd love to get to just the content, but we've got so much code that's like pointless, except it's solving a problem someone had in 1998, which then caused a problem in 2001, so some more code was written. And it's the same reason Netscape stopped being a good browser until they threw out the rendering engine. It's the same reason, you know, Internet Explorer has trouble modernizing because they've got all this legacy code and they have to keep supporting the poor bastard who bought the multi-million-dollar piece of crap's CRM that requires, you know, IE5 0.5 functionality, right? So they can't just go, we're going to throw this away. And so, I mean, that's the problem with Drupal. It's a problem with any platform. And it's not even limited to Drupal. Again, if you were to, in the front-end world, if you were to say, I really like a multi-column layout, and I'd like to do responsive design, I'd like to do a flexible grid, but I'm not sure how to do it. Well, there's someone else made a flexible grid for you. And, you know, it's a platform. You could get it. But you're going to have, like, 500 lines of CSS to make it work and 50 lines of JavaScript. And maybe if you wrote it yourself, you could do it in 10 lines, right? That's the problem. When people create frameworks and they solve multiple people's problems...
You're carrying that with you, right? All that CSS for the grid layout that you're not using, that's an option for this grid layout.
Exactly.
You're bringing along and delivering to everyone.
As Drupal gets more powerful, it becomes kind of like Microsoft Word, where most of the code base is for stuff I'm never going to use. Most of the bloat in Microsoft Word is for stuff I don't even know it does.
Right.
Word art. If I wanted to make a magazine layout in Word, I could. Right? I could draw three-dimensional graphics if I wanted to. I'm never going to do that stuff. I just want a spell checker and I want headlines and subheads. But there's all that other code for the people who do have the need, you know, because Microsoft's like, we can't ignore all these customers. They're like, you know, if 10% of our customers want to be able to design logos in Microsoft Word, we're going to let them do that. You know, we're looking at $1 billion in sales. We're not going to say no. So I think really what you're talking about is the problem of scale. And I wish I could give you the solution, but, I think it all depends, and really the only thing I can say is write your own stuff whenever possible, even though, you know, you can leverage the power of a platform by using plugins, but there's a trade-off. Know the trade-off.
Well, I'm thinking about the flexibility, not in terms of what you can do, but sometimes what you can take out, what you cannot do. Is a good idea, and it's so we built a site, a URL shortener site,
nice.
lb.cm. It's the Lullabot Vanity URL shortener,
right.
And we built it on Drupal. I spent a weekend and thought I could build a module to do URL shortening in Drupal, and it does. You know, it actually, the module itself routes around a whole lot of Drupal's code. It doesn't even bootstrap all of Drupal when you're just doing a redirect. But then the site itself, you know, you don't need a whole lot of content on a very simple site like that. And it ends up really not looking like Drupal. And to some extent, I think for some of us in Drupal, there's sort of that feeling of like, well, why use Drupal for something like this? But it's a nice exercise in not, you know, in what you can not do in Drupal, you know, sort of taking out a lot of stuff and trying to simplify it. It does have that flexibility as well.
Cool.
Yeah.
Go ahead. Sorry.
I was going to say, I think a lot of the complexity ends up being created because we have all these tools out there, content management systems. Some of them, like WordPress, are maybe more targeted to solving a specific problem, like building blog websites, but Drupal especially is an example of a tool where we've got something that's trying to create a way to build things that are quickly reusable, and it's like there's a big trade-off that happens in the quickly and a big trade-off that happens in the reusable. So a lot of the best work I think that I've been seeing happen in the Drupal community has been toward providing simpler ways for the end developers and the end front-end guys using Drupal to sort of take over. So like the semantic views project that happened in Drupal 6 led to the way the views interface works in Drupal 7, which like stops, you know, building nested div upon nested div upon nested div and says, well, if you'd like to just take over this output and do what you want with it, you can, and do it fairly simply. Yeah, and so I think just an awareness of that need is something that maybe wasn't there, you know, several years ago, but it's becoming more and more. It's kind of ironic that it's taking until 2011 before there's this strong awareness of the need for nice, clean semantic markup. But thanks to books that Zeldman writes, it catches on eventually.
Cool. I'll take that.
Take it. So, other than keynoting at the Do It With Drupal conference, what are you excited about these days?
Oh, wow. Yeah, I'm very excited.
See
about
how I work that in there?
It's good. It's nice. It's nice. I'm very excited about that. I'm very excited about an event at Park DC coming up in October with 3 days of design, code, and content, including a day apart on accessible web design, right? Which is an optional whole day on accessibility, and you know, and kind of because an event apart is an advanced conference for web designers and developers. It's not, you know, it's not going to be the baby accessibility stuff that everybody listening to this knows. It's going to be using progressive enhancement and CSS3 and HTML5, ARIA, and JavaScript for bulletproof functionality on websites that work for everyone, including people with disabilities. And our Derek Featherstone is that, you know Derek.
I do.
He's a brilliant guy, wonderful guy, fun guy. He's doing that day. So I'm excited about that. I'm excited about some new projects Happy Cog is doing. One we just released, but can't talk about.
that was the one that we worked on.
I know.
We just found out at the beginning of this.
Yeah, both our companies worked on this project and neither one knew. And
we can't talk about it.
It's like working for the Kremlin.
Yeah, I remember at the beginning of the project hearing buzz that Happy Cog was going to be involved or something, but it is kind of funny how...
But that's sort of an interesting state of things, right? It used to be that, you know, there was one company that worked on any given website or one person, right, the webmaster. I still cringe when I hear people use the word webmaster these days. And now it's, you know, it's gotten so... well, there's that word again, modular, you know, where you've got different aspects of a project and different expertises that come in for different different aspects of thing. I think it's
or different relationships.
I think it's good.
Yeah,
I think it's a good thing. And it's neat that you can do that kind of stuff these days. And Drupal in particular lends itself well to that with the sort of conceptual separation of the functionality from the design and content, and you can have people sort of working on all those different things at once without necessarily having too much interaction with each other.
It's our old friend, the word modularity again.
Yeah.
And it is good. We at Happy Hug, we love to do as much of it as possible because we're kind of holistic in our approach. We really love to be involved in research, user experience, design, front end and back end, but we don't have to be. And I prefer it when we actually collaborate. And what's usually the case is that we know who we're collaborating with and we actually talk to them. And I think that makes for a better experience if you can actually sit down with them from the beginning of the project and say, right, and just keep... just keep touching base so that, you know, and then not just hand it off and walk away, but hand it off in quotes and stay involved.
Yeah.
So because, you know, the whole thing is so iterative. And as you know, half the time when you're implementing something, you realize, oh, there's a flaw in the logic of the user experience. Oh, you know, if we do, or this won't work given what we know about our system, this won't work. So it's always better when... If you're not doing everything, you're at least talking to. I mean, that's how web design works, really. Yeah. That's how all this stuff works.
You don't, if you're not careful, you end up with the Pontiac Aztec.
I don't know what that means, but I love it.
It was a vehicle that General Motors designed using separate teams that didn't collaborate.
Is that the one that had a tent?
Yeah, it had this like a toad mating look it could perform, like with this pop-out tent on the back. And
yeah, you could camp in it. It was a vehicle that you could camp in. And
yeah,
it was very really not bizarre. A very good-looking car.
It had like bad blind spots that were due to like decisions. It doesn't
look
that
too bad.
Yeah.
It's a mid-sized crossover, according to this, 2005.
Yeah. One of the early
ones. Time magazine called it the worst car of all time.
Well, it's hard to see with that tent flapping in the wind while you're driving down the highway.
And in 2010, they called it the 34th worst invention of all time. That's bad, because think about things that have been invented.
There have been a lot of things invented, and some of them have been really bad.
Some, I mean, think of it, you know, that means that it's like worse than some of the things that were invented for the Crusades. Like some, you know, something that not only knocks down a castle wall, but like impales the soldier on the other side of it on a stick. This is worse. This is worse.
Yeah.
They're like, that was pretty bad. This is worse. Wow. Television commercials portray the Aztec as an adult. My buddy. All right, we should stop. This is getting into a whole weird area.
We'll have to do that on our other podcast.
Your other podcast.
Bad cars throughout history. Yeah. Nice. So, speaking of inventions and technology, it just seems like there are a whole lot of new web technologies that are really starting to hit that tipping point right now.
Yeah.
I mean, and you've got books apart about several of them, but downloadable fonts and people, you know, web people starting to think about font usage in a way that they weren't able to do before, and even just the tools starting to get better. Have you tried out this Adobe Muse? That's their like temporary name. They said they're not going to call it.
It says like it's code name Muse.
Yeah,
I saw an early preview of it and was actually impressed with what it could do. Although I still have the problem. I know they were working hard on it, but I saw the problem that. It's, you know, if you think of it purely as graphic design, you can do amazing stuff, but it's really hard to write semantic code.
Right.
It, you know, yes. Everything is kind of a div. So part of me died. When I saw, like a year ago, I saw a gentleman who worked on it, what is now called Muse. I saw this gentleman just making the most beautiful layouts, and they were bulletproof in that it was writing. And it was writing plenty, again, this is the Drupal problem. It was writing plenty of code so that even in IE6, you could have this, like, you know, 17-column masterpiece with, like, text flowing from one side to the other. It was doing all the stuff that we can do, but it's very hard to write. It was doing all that, and I thought, wow, you know, if I'm a graphic designer, I certainly want to use that. I certainly want to use it more than I would want to use Apple's or what...
iWeb.
iWeb, right. That was, I had a friend who worked on that, and she's very talented. Adobe says, well, you know, who writes, John Nacka said, well, who writes PostScript by hand? And people aren't going to write web code by hand. So I just, you know, I think I disagree, and I don't think it's a fair comparison. I don't think anyone listening to this program thinks that they're going to be replaced anytime soon by a piece of software. You know, I just don't see it happening. If I were a talented graphic designer who didn't want to learn about the web, I could see using the product. If I were a school teacher who needed to get a page up quickly, and it's not going to be indexed by Google, and no one has accessibility problems, who's going to use the page? And you want it to look pretty, and you have a little talent, I think it would be a great product. I think if it's aimed at professional designers, and I'm not sure. And again, I've written about this at Zeldman.com. I just don't think it's possible. I don't think it's possible to make a Photoshop-type tool that thinks semantically and that thinks flexibly and fluidly and all the other stuff that we have to do.
Well, there's still that problem of if not Flash, then what? And it's nice to see Adobe at least trying to solve this problem themselves. I think they realize that Steve Jobs is not entirely incorrect.
Right. No, I agree. And I think it will serve... I think it will be useful for a lot of people, but I don't see Dan Cederholm...
Yeah.
Or Tim Murtaugh or any of the, you know, Jen Lucas, any of the people I know and work with, I don't see myself using it ever.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm impressed, and I wish I didn't have this problem. I feel like, you know what I feel like? I feel like a Jew looking at a plate of bacon and going, damn, that looks tasty, but you know what? Can't do it. Huh. I feel like that. I'm looking at it.
But maybe there is that aspect of it. Again, it can provide...
Like There's a religious, like, well, I can't use that. I'd love to. I'd love to make web pages that look awesome and don't require me to think.
But it provides the competition. It provides I can do that without that. I can do that and do it with standards and accessibility provides something for the rest of us to strive for, maybe?
Yeah. I mean, it's not going to – so I was just – the other day I was looking at a site called Melt Media. And if you go to meltmedia.com, you'll see it. And it's a really – pretty. They're a competitor of Abacus. They're an agency in Arizona, very good, and they had just done a responsive redesign, and it's a really nice responsive redesign. I don't see the level of code that they wrote and what they were doing. I don't see that coming out of a tool anytime. But I can imagine a situation where a designer at a company might use might say, you know what, I don't want to do this in Photoshop. It'll take too long. I'm going to use Muse to show them what I'm thinking for these different sizes. Mm-hmm. And then I'll use that almost as a way to make a comp, which I'll then take to a real front-end developer who'll throw out all of the code or most of the code. They might say, you know what, the way you set the type is fine. I can keep that part. You know, the way Muse set the type is fine. I don't even know. I'm just making these examples up. But
right.
I can see it playing a collaborative part.
Yeah, it's basically Photoshop, but you get to start from assigning a grid instead of assigning a specific canvas size, and it starts to think a little bit more like the web in the sense that you can actually create some styles for things. Like you can say,
yes,
here's my paragraph style. This is what an H1 is going to look like. This
Which
is what
I can
an
never
H2
do.
Look.
You can never do that in Photoshop.
Yeah,
right.
So
it's
if
like
you're
an
building
InDesign.
Mocks, yeah. If you're building mocks, it's a big improvement potentially over Photoshop. But I think the saddest I felt watching the promo video for it was when the engineer said, you know, I think in 5 to 10 years you won't see any designers ever doing coding. And I thought, wow, like if that's the goal of the product, I think it's going to fail.
That might just be something that sounds good in marketing that they're running with. I don't, that's never going to happen.
Yeah.
That's never going to happen. Any, you know what? And there's no product that's going to replace a book designer either.
Yeah.
There's no. That's not, you know what I think. What the. But we could go on and on. We could go on and on. But we're not going to.
So what is good?
What is good? So I don't know. I haven't found it. This might be better.
I don't mean just as like as an all-encompassing tool. But,
you know what? That tool might replace Photoshop in my comping repertoire. I can see that happening. So it would be good for that purpose. But. Man, just because it has styles and such. But, you know, but I can use Illustrator for that, too. I don't know. I just don't... I really don't know.
Sorry, I didn't mean this to be such a downer.
You stumped him.
No, it's not a downer. I mean, I think a combination of some kind of drawing tool, even if it's a pencil and a paper, and then coding is, you know...
Yeah.
Well, and we're seeing, you know, with the state of standards and the tools that are out there, I know, Jared, you're spending a lot less time in Photoshop these days making complete mock-ups that you can kind of get an idea and then using CSS start to actually do more design kinds of stuff in the browser. Just
yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think that it's in so many instances, it's just so much speedier. But it's also nice to be designing visually in ways that are easily achieved without lots of background images and things like that as well.
But, yeah.
I think mocks continue to play a role in design processes, but it's becoming a lot more complicated.
We get out of them quicker.
Yes, yeah. I do everything I can to move past them as quickly as possible. And
for instance, on a thing we're doing now, so there's an actual fairly detailed mock-up of the way the page looks in a desktop browser. Uh-huh. And then everything else is happening in code, and it's collaboration between the front-end developer and the designer, going back and forth talking, well, what about this? Right. I'm thinking I'd move. I'm thinking we change to the other logo here at this size. I'm thinking we move this up. Mm-hmm. You know, so it's really wonderful. It reminds me, this kind of intense collaboration reminds me of the way, because I was in advertising before I was in web design, and, you know, art director and copywriter sitting there, you know, figuring stuff out the whole time together, locked in the same room with each other. It's a really, really good, it creates something that you could never have if a writer shoved a headline under an art director's door, or if a, back when people had doors, I'm dating myself. Right?
How when far I started, have we come?
When I started, we had offices. And we smoked in them.
Just like and drank.
We drank. We womanized.
As long as it was afternoon, start belting them away. This Melt Media site is actually a pretty good example. There are a lot of good examples, but if people listening to the podcast want to see an example of this adaptive, responsive design stuff, it's really interesting as you resize your browser to different sizes what happens with this page. Meltmedia.com. Also some good use of downloadable fonts. It's really interesting. At the largest size, their logo pops down into the design.
Get them on your show.
We'll get everybody on the show, man. It's a party. Cool. Well, thanks for coming on the podcast. Thanks for speaking at Do It With Drupal. We're really excited about that.
Excited about that. And thank you. Thank you for inviting me to do that, and thank you for having me on the show. You guys are great. It's a party.
Yeah, yeah.
Next time I'll bring Doritos.
Woo! Cool. Woo-hoo. Okay. All right. Well, thanks a lot, and we'll see you next time.